Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a wonderful show for you all today. My guest will be Beth Hoffman. She's the author of a wonderful new book called Bet the Farm, and she's a former journalist. I'll tell you more about her in just a little bit, but first I want to tell you some things that are going on around my world, some things in the news, some ways you can take action, and of course, share this week's recipe with you. So this past weekend, there were marches all across New York State for climate change and asking New York State to strengthen their policies. And there were marches and rallies up in Albany, in Rochester, Buffalo, New York City. And they were great. You know, unfortunately, I didn't hear about more of in the news, which is always sad, but it was they were great. And I wish I could have been there. I actually couldn't be there this week, past weekend, but I would have been if I could. I miss going to rallies. I'll tell you one thing that a fellow activist once said to me when I was asking her how she doesn't get depressed with all of the realities of stuff going on in the world. She says she surrounds herself with other activists. And when you're surrounding yourself with other activists, you feel the positivity and the hope and the dynamic energy of people working together, and that lifts your spirit. And so I encourage everybody to become active participants in our world, because there's so many different issues that you can get behind. Everyone can't do everything, but everyone can do something. And so pick your topic, whether it's food, agriculture, climate, whatever it is, and we know they are all connected. Pick something that you can get passionate about and really help to move it forward. We need our grassroots people on the ground making change. This past Saturday was also World Kindness Day, which I love the idea of a World Kindness Day. And as we approach Thanksgiving, you know, I want people to really think about giving thanks and gratitude, and whose land are we really sitting on? You know, is it really the pilgrim's land, or is it the indigenous people who were here before us? And give thanks to the land that we are on and recognize where our country came from. The climate summit has come to a close, and the United Nations, you know, draft agreement, you know, is really encouraging countries to work together and to strengthen their pledges for for addressing global emissions, because the way it looks, even if everybody does what they say they're going to do, we're still not going to get to where we need to be in order to avert the worst catastrophes of global warming. So I beg everybody to take this issue really seriously for your kids, for your grandchildren, for the planet. We need to, you know, really let our elected officials know how important climate change is to all of us. And, you know, last week I was at the annual conference of NOFA New York, not conference, board meeting for NOFA New York. And we were just talking about how climate change is affecting farmers already across the country and across the world. And this is our food supply, and we really need to protect it. And I'm sure we will get into that more in my conversation just a little bit with Beth Hoffman, who you know, left her journalism work and set out to start a farm. And she'll tell us all about that. I want to share with all of you this week's recipe. So last week, I also shared a Thanksgiving recipe. It was my Thanksgiving, my pumpkin cheesecake, which was a vegan pumpkin cheesecake. This one is vegan stuffing with mushrooms, apples, and pecans. And next week, I'm sure I'll have another Thanksgiving recipe for you. So I do start with a prepackaged stuffing mix, whether you get the vegan Arrowhead Mills one, or a Cascadian Farm one, or 365 one. Just make sure it's a vegan one, if that matters to you. Look at the ingredients, make sure there's not added sugar and anything bad in it. And good ones do exist. So get a stuffing mix that you like. To that, these are the ingredients you want to have. 1.5 cups of a vegetable broth. You can make your own, which is lovely, or you can buy a good vegetable broth. 1/3 cup of olive oil or coconut oil, plus 2 tablespoons. 1 onion chopped, 2 stalks celery chopped, 1 package, 8 ounces worth of baby mushrooms. I like to use the baby portobello mushrooms, but you can use any organic mushroom you like. 2 gala apples. I use Granny Smith, but again, you can use whatever apples you have on hand. 1 cup of chopped pecans that I dry toasted. 1 tablespoon of poultry spice, and that's a mix of parsley, sage, rosemary, tarragon. What else is in there? Probably garlic. But anyway, a poultry spice, or you can make your own poultry spice. 1 tablespoon chopped garlic and 1/2 cup of fresh herbs, and that would be thyme, rosemary, sage, parsley. So you're going to bring the vegetable broth to a boil along with the oil. And then when that is, the oil's melted, or the coconut oil's melted, you're going to add the stuffing mix to that. Just stir it and let it sit covered for about 5 minutes. Meanwhile, in the other 2 tablespoons of olive oil, you're going to saute the onions for about 5 minutes. Add the celery and garlic and cook for another 5 minutes, maybe even 10 minutes. You want to taste the celery and make sure that it's really soft. Then you can add the mushrooms, the apples, the poultry spice, and cook for another 5 minutes or so. Add the toasted pecans, add the sauteed vegetables that you just cooked up, add that to the bowl of the stuffing mix and mix that up really well. Chop all the fresh herbs up and you're gonna add those and then put it into a baking dish and bake it. Actually, you could stop at that point and wait until Thanksgiving Day, and then on Thanksgiving Day, put it into a casserole and bake it in the oven for about 20 minutes. And that will let all the fresh herbs infiltrate the whole dish. And it just is delicious. Garnish it with some fresh parsley before serving. And that is it. Comes together really easily. It's delicious. And you will not miss anything that is not vegan in there. Now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you, Beth Hoffman. She's the author of a new book called Beth the Farm. And Beth is a beginning farmer on about 530 acres in Iowa. For the last 20 years, she's worked as a journalist covering food and agriculture. And her work has been aired and published on NPR's Morning Edition, The Guardian, The Salt, Latino USA, and NewsHour. And this is her journey of leaving journalism to become a farmer, and the struggles that came with that, and how one can actually make a living doing it. So welcome, Beth.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So I loved your story. I thought, you know, before I really get into any of the questions, I am curious as to what inspired you to leave your work as a journalist from San Francisco, California, and venture out into Iowa.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I guess it could be argued you can't ever really leave journalism, that all those skills and attitudes kind of come with you no matter where you go, your research brain and absolutely, just kind of questioning. So, but I was living in Berkeley initially when I met my husband. He is from Iowa. He, within the first 5 minutes, told me that he was moving back to Iowa once his kids were grown, and that he wanted to take over the family's farm. So that seed was planted right from our initial meeting. And I knew that it was always something that was going to happen. We started spending summers on the farm, and it was just like, it wasn't very real until the past few years when we really started to work on like a lease with his dad. In order for us to take over, we needed to be able to pay his dad something each year, because like most farmers, most of the money is in the land. It's not sitting in a bank account that he had from years of farming. So that was really the impetus about it. But after researching and reporting on food and agriculture for 20 years, it also felt really like an interesting gift to be able to go put what you've learned into practice. Although, you know, the challenges were going to be many, and they really were.
Mm-hmm. One thing that, you know, has become very obvious here in New York and especially on Long Island, the cost of land is so expensive that very often farmers just sell out to a developer as opposed to keeping it in a farm because they can make more money that way than actually selling it to another farmer. Is it similar to that in Iowa?
In certain areas, and I would say not for development, but for continuing agriculture. So there's been some record sales this year that have just been mind-blowing. Like there was just a sale for $18,000 an acre in northern Iowa. It's not clear why you would do that. I mean, I think investors think that land is a good, you know, asset class. It's going to keep its value as opposed to maybe the stock market and other things that are all over the place. So that kind of investment has really picked up in the last couple of years. I think just the pandemic has made everyone so uneasy. And we see real estate, particularly agricultural land, really skyrocketing the cost.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying $18,000 an acre as if that's a lot, correct?
That is a lot for just, you know, non-developable, like not near a town, not near a city. You're not going to put a house on it. It's just for agriculture. That's a lot.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Okay. You know, just trying to get a sense because here on Long Island, that would be the biggest bargain in the world.
Right.
Know?
Right.
But people here are spending, you know, over $100,000 an acre.
Yeah, but that's developable land. Yeah. So you could,
right.
You could imagine in that case, okay, if I bought, you know, $100,000 acre of land and I put in X amount of units and I, you know, I could sell it back for an amount of money that makes sense. But in the Midwest, when you're talking about, I'm going to spend, you know, $18,000, $20,000 an acre and then raise corn on it. Corn, I mean, right now you can make, it's somewhere like, let's say about $400 an acre is probably what net income
right.
you could make, which wouldn't pay obviously the mortgage for that.
Sure,
so you would never,
sure.
the return
Thank
on investment is
that.
Incredibly
right.
low. Right.
So what were some of the biggest challenges of taking over and managing the farm?
Well, first off, was that John's dad was still there. So he was in his early 80s when we started this process. But it's a very difficult process to transition land from one generation to the next. Because a lot of times people in the family have very different ideas about what should happen and who wants to farm and people who don't want to farm. And it can get very, very complicated. In our case, John and his sisters were pretty well aligned that they all wanted John to be farming it. We're all pretty well aligned in, you know, the kinds of practices, the more sustainable practices that we want to see on the farm. So the real stumbling block was John's dad, who had grown conventionally corn and soybeans and cattle on this land and was very confused and just uneasy about the idea, like, we're going to come in, the city slickers, you know, living in San Francisco and bring in our, you know, coast ideas about, oh, we're going to do organics and we're going to do grass-finished beef, which is what we do. And he just didn't really understand how that was going to make any money. And I think he was rightfully, you know, worried just in general about how, where farming is going and how would we make any money anyway. So that was the biggest problem. And it just took a lot of time, you know, and a lot of conversations about what we were intending and how it would work if we couldn't pay the lease and how we could ensure that we wouldn't lose the whole farm in that process.
Right. Right. And did he stay on the farm with you?
He still lives there. He is 89. He is married to a woman who's been quite supportive of us transitioning the land. So she was pretty instrumental in helping us get the lease and get moving. Mm-hmm. He's still there.
Mm-hmm. Good. Okay. So in the book, you detail many of the reasons why farms make so little, like the high cost of machinery and seed, the low prices of farm products, and the consolidation of the market. But you also talk about the role of storytelling in limiting farmers' ability to be successful. Can you discuss what you mean by that?
Yeah, I talk about in the book two different distinct but overlapping sort of myths, one of which is the bigger is better myth, which I think your listeners, will be very... they know, we all have heard these myths, that's why they're called myths, is that the idea that you have to get bigger, you need more equipment, like you're saying, better seeds, more land, and that's at the point at which farms become profitable. And I deconstructed that myth to say it's not only problematic for the environment, it's problematic in the sense that what it does is makes farmers feel like they're in competition with one another, and it drives ever increasing yields. So what's happened is, and you can see over time throughout history, you have this increasing yields end up with overproduction of whatever product it is. And you can see time and time again how that then leads to, basic economic theories. If you have way too much supply, the demand is not there and the prices start falling. And this in farming usually gets exacerbated because then farmers produce even more in order to make up for their losses. And the price keeps dropping. And you couple that with a lot of debt that farmers take on to be in that game of having bigger machinery. It means you probably have to take out a loan in order to buy that bigger tractor. And so it's cycles of debt and oversupply. So that's what's one of the things that's difficult with that myth. The other myth, though, that people who are more in the sustainable food world will be kind of familiar with is this very idealistic notion of farming that I call the agrarian myth. Many people call it the agrarian myth. And this is something that even from the time of Thomas Jefferson, he started writing letters about how farmers were really the heart of the American dream. And they were sort of the most virtuous, hands in the dirt, honest people. And we've kind of evolved this myth to now include, like, you're going to head back to the farm and live this simple life and get your hands in the dirt. But it's also about stewarding the land. And we've got to have agriculture and sustainable agriculture, improve what's going on with the climate, and also nourish our communities, which if you think about it, what other job has those sorts of lofty goals? I mean, they're massive goals to steward the earth and nourish the community. And you end up with farmers that are feel really this burden of having to take care of those things and not take care of their own mental health in many cases, and certainly their own financial well-being. So they undercut their own prices. They sell things for less than the cost of production, for example, and work enormous amounts of hours and then burn out in 3 years. There's not much you can do to keep that going on and on and on. So those are the two myths that I talk about.
Uh-huh. And in the first myth, you talked about kind of setting up the farmers to compete with each other. Do you find that with other farmers, that there's a sense of competition and not wanting to share their secrets. Because I know, you know, I'm a slow food. I run my local slow food chapter, and I've gone to Italy many times for Terra Madre, the International Slow Food Conference. And there's such a sense of collaboration amongst farmers that I have picked up with. And yet I get the sense here that there's more competition. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think they're a little bit two different things. Like, I think that the competition is really in the commodity world. So when you're growing a product that has no real, it's not branded in a certain way. It's just for the mass market, your product goes into a bin with everybody else's product of the same kind. In that world, you end up with a lot of competition. And you see this in the advertising. There's a lot of advertising of conventional products, chemicals, and seeds, for example, that uses sort of war language, like you've got to win the battle and you've got to beat your competition. And it ends up driving farmers to just produce as much as they can. So they're not so much like hostile to each other. It's the fact it ends up being that it's very difficult then for farmers to work with each other. And one of the main ways they could do so would be by limiting their own supply. So you could have farmers actually work together to decide how much would be supplied to the larger market. And there's tons of farmer cooperatives. They're some of the oldest cooperatives in the country, are mainly in the Midwest kind of farmer cooperatives that work together sometimes to do that. You know, they aggregate the product and then you can sit on it if the price isn't right, you know, and wait until the price goes up. That's something that you can do when you're working together. But it's not so much there's a hostility between farmers as there's just like a race to grow more is what ends up happening.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Now you also talk in the book about, you say that in order to solve the U.S.'s agricultural problems, we first need a new national narrative around farming. What would that narrative be?
Well, that's one of the first places, like in terms of changing that language about competition to farmers working together to do things, like I was saying, limit supply. That would be a great place to start. And, you know, in the book, I kind of walk through different levels of changing those narratives from the personal. So even just on the personal level, the individual level of a farmer, you can change and say, okay, I'm not going to have that agrarian myth dictate my life. I'm not the rugged individual out in the fields by myself, virtuous and taking care of business, like getting the job done. I could be somebody who works with other farmers, asks for help when I need help, takes care of my own mental health and stress levels first and foremost. That would be an entirely different kind of narrative. So that's just an example. I also talk about, so from the personal to the farm level, to farms in regions working together in different ways. And then looking at it from a more of a national policy level, an international policy level. And changing the narratives, again, to be one that is not all about competition and higher yields and getting out of that bigger is better race to the bottom, and changing the narrative to be something that was much more that took into account, obviously, the environmental aspects of agriculture, but also helps think about policies that change the economic outcomes for farmers. So this could kind of, in viewing, my thesis is that, you know, in viewing things differently, if we tell different stories about agriculture, if we change from war language to being something that takes into account the nutritional aspects and the stewarding of the land and the personal well-being of farmers, that could have really large implications on how we then approach solutions.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that would be lovely. do farmers work cooperatively in sharing equipment? Because I know equipment seems to be, you know, especially with the larger farms, you know, such a huge investment. Is it possible for farmers to share equipment?
Well, I think at this point, when you're talking about really large commodity farms, one of the main problems, obviously, is that everybody needs the same equipment at the same time. You all need a planter at the same time. You all need a combine, you know, to harvest at the same time. So it makes it very difficult. But it's definitely not impossible. I mean, I think that if you, especially if they were smaller farms, it makes a lot of sense to share equipment. So one of the things on our farm we're trying to do is to think about a model that we're calling co-farming, where we would, the land would stay in ownership of the family, because it's a little too complicated right now to think about taking it out of family hands. There's too many people in the family who want to retain the land. But to bring on farmers that would then own their own enterprises to farm for free. And then we would have things like shared equipment, things that you can buy in bulk. I mean, I think that's some of the things that cooperatives are really good at. You know, you can buy together seeds, let's say, and then have discounts, you know, for larger amounts. So I think on smaller farms, it does make a lot of sense. But then again, you have to make sure that, you know, the area that you're talking about, you know, in the Hudson Valley, for example, it might make a lot of sense because you could get from farm to farm without it being too much distance to travel. But in rural Iowa, that might be a different situation.
Mm-hmm. What are the challenges in converting a conventional farm to organic? I mean, we've all heard, you know, have heard about the negative aspects of monocropping and the bigger is not necessarily better, and, you know, GMO crops. And we all of us that care kind of have heard this story.
Yeah.
But why is it so difficult when the science is in and people know, including farmers, know that transitioning to organic can help mitigate the climate issues, is better for the land, is better for our health? I mean, there's so many reasons to do it. What is the, you know, big stopping block there?
Yeah, I think this was one of the main reasons why I wrote the book, right? I've had this for many years as a reporter, this sort of lingering question in my brain, like, okay, I read this, you know, you here's this great farm, they're doing all these great things and everything seems perfect. And so the lingering question was always, if it's so great, why isn't everybody doing it? And I really wanted to understand a lot more about that, which is one of the reasons why I wrote the book. And there's a lot of reasons. I would say, in answer to your question, one of the main things that I also then found out and tried to tackle in the book is the economics of it. So yes, it makes sense for a farm, ecologically speaking, to go organic. There's really no doubt that it's better for all the animals, the plants, the flora, the fauna, everybody does better. But economically speaking, it's a very difficult transition for farmers for many reasons. So one would be that if you think about where many farms are located, they're not that close to big population centers. So what are you going to do with the product once you have it is a big question. And the economics and just the labor side of it, when you think about trying to build your own infrastructure of a system that doesn't exist in your area, like if we grew a lot of cucumbers or apples even, or things that were much more delicate, you know, than an apple that you really have to sell quite quickly. I mean, it takes a lot of infrastructure to then get it from the farm to the customer in a streamlined manner that gets it there fresh, that can absorb a lot of product. So in the Midwest, one of the main reasons why there are commodity crops is that they store really well. So you can be very far from population centers and yet, you know, have a crop, you harvest it, it goes in a grain bin, it can sit there for years even, and find the right time to sell. So that's one of the main issues. Another really big problem is that in that transition of time, like I asked my husband, John, you know, why'd your father never do anything different? Why wouldn't he have grown organic or whatever thing, different things? And he said, you know, when you're in that cycle of borrowing money and having to pay off loans, you cannot take a year or two or three in the case of organics off to in order to make that transition. You can't afford to have no income for that amount of time in between. So one of the things that would be very helpful in helping people transition is a loan moratorium, for example, where the loans would not necessarily go away, but you could take a three-year period of time to make the transition and then have your loans be on hold in that period of time. That would be enormously helpful. So it's that, and then there's just the knowledge aspect where if there's not a bunch of USDA agents and extension agents and all of these people in your immediate area that can help you figure out how to transition, what you might grow, what you could sell, how to market, it becomes just, it's way too much to figure out how to do on your own. And the older farmers get, the less anybody takes on massive change in something that they've learned to do their whole lives. You know, it's a very difficult thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I feel like, you know, our government led farmers down this path, you know, in the Green Revolution, the monocropping and the bigger is better and all of that. And we need to push our government to create programs and pathways to get them out of this system, like you were saying, with the loan moratorium or, you know, cooperatives or helping to build the infrastructure so that it exists, so that it's not up to the farmer to build it. Do you have any recommendations from the work that you've been doing as to how, for instance, my listeners can, you know, write to congresspeople or petitioners or, you know, because I'm always preaching like we have to be active, and this is one of the areas that we really have to be active.
Yeah. Well, I would say just in response to thinking about the history of it, that it didn't kind of all of a sudden happen. It's been evolving. And one of the things that I was very surprised to learn early on was that even John's great-great-grandfather grew corn and grew mostly corn and had animals, livestock animals that they fed corn to. And so it's not that it's a very embedded cultural situation where families have been doing this for generations. And I think it's one of the things that people don't understand in like a sustainable food world. We kind of chalk it up to like people being misinformed or farmers being brainwashed by agribusiness or something like that. And I think that it's really important if we want to find the solutions to understand that A, families have always grown these things. The scale is different now. But families were not growing all kinds of fruits and vegetables and selling them at market. Like that never was a thing. So we can't romanticize and idealize and say, oh, we should go back to that, because that never was. And I think it's also it's important to think about a path ahead that, you know, takes into account, how do we change culture? How do we make it not just a government kind of a program thing? Because what ends up happening is the Farm Bill has made a lot of these programs so convoluted and they're so complicated that farmers honestly don't even understand how they're actually getting paid for anything. It's not a very clear, like, I do X and I get paid Y. That doesn't exist. So I would really say pushing land grant universities is a great place. We all have state universities that we should be like pounding down their doors and saying, we need more sustainable food research. We need more extension workers that are out there actually helping people transition and learn new things and learn new ways of doing things. I think that's a really potent place that we could make some real ground, get some real ground. But, I think that one of the things as well is that in a world right now where we've become so divisive, so it's overwhelming. You know, I don't know about your listeners, but it feels to me like the levels of anxiety are on the rise again, just from they were maybe not so crazy. And so I think that, like you were saying, really staying hopeful and really looking for ways that you don't make yourself feel guilty and stressed, but you take action and you learn. If you want to know more about how it works, engage in that activity and learn more about how it works, and just pick that one thing exactly like you're saying and show up, do it. So I think that we all would love, and I've been asked this question by everybody I've been interviewed by, like, what can we do? You know, man, if there were just like clear solutions, we'd be doing them, but there's not. So let's just each do something and it builds up. It really does.
Right. So we all know land is expensive and valuable. Combine that with the fact that most family farms have been in white hands for generations. There's little room for others to become farmers. How might this be corrected so that more opportunities are available? And what can white farmers do to help Black, Indigenous, or other farmers of color gain more ground?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I wish everybody were asking this question more often. It's something that I really tried to also address in the book. So I looked at our situation very admittedly through privileged eyes. And I talked about that at great length in the book, that we came into this with a lot of privilege, meaning that we had family wealth that had built up over generations that many people of color, not just farmers, but haven't had the ability to do, hasn't been legal to do. And we also had this access to land, as you mentioned. There's great work afoot with leadership in the BIPOC community, Black, Indigenous, farmers of color of all kinds. There's really great leadership from them. And I would just say that I'm not the one that should be saying, here's how it should be done, other white people. But I will say, as a white, you know, middle-aged woman, that one of the things that I really learned in this process was that when I started saying things like, you know, oh, we'd love to have people of color come work on the farm with us, and I started asking around and making those statements, and I was you know, sort of when I was talking to one person in particular, I outlined this whole situation in the book, but, you know, she said to me, look, there's a lot of discussion, and I'm getting a lot of calls by white women like you who are saying, we'd like to help. And you have to realize that this has been going on. It's not just the land. It's not just like, okay, here, I've got land. People of color come work on the land. there's this whole system that's been built up around that is not also helpful to people of color in getting them to stay on the land once people are there. So there's lots going on. Like I said, for example, keeping Black farmers on the land, making land more accessible to Black farmers, younger farmers, veterans, women, all sorts of great programming. And I will say that the land back movement by Indigenous communities is also very helpful. And that's something that we're really considering, is that if we don't have someone to take over the land, why do we need to keep that wealth just kind of circulating in our family? If there's other wealth and everybody's taken care of and it's all good, why not just simply give the land back? And I think that's something that people should consider. So there's a whole hashtag and communities out there talking about that. So I would say, look that up, land back.
Yeah. Well, especially, I think, you know, you mentioned the land grant universities. You know, there's so much information out there now about where their money actually came from to start with, right? So much of their yes. funding came from stealing the land to start with, where the government stole it and then gave it to them.
Correct. Yes. And I think that's, you know, happened for all of our families. You know, look, in 1851, when John's great, great grandfather came to Iowa, it was the same year that the last tribal treaty was signed in Iowa. And it was also the year of an exclusionary law for Blacks. So freed Blacks and mulattoes, that's the language in the law, were not allowed to stay in Iowa if they came into Iowa. They had 3 days to leave. So that's the setup. Oh, miraculously, you know, John's great-great-grandfather could then afford to purchase land under that context. So I think as individuals and also as a nation and land grant universities, all of that, we all have to take responsibility for that. It's not like, again, I'm not saying like feel guilty, go home and, you know, sob about that situation, do something about it. You know, we can rectify these problems. They're not beyond our scope.
Okay. Well, I will definitely look up the land back movement and maybe, get someone from that organization to actually come on the show and talk more about it, because it keeps coming up. You know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, I'm on the NOFA board, the Northeast Organic Farming Association. You know, it's predominantly white run organization, and like all these white run organizations, we want it to be more integrated and more diverse, but it's not. And you know, we're always trying to think of ways to make it more diverse, but the majority of the farmers that have the land, you know, were able to come into it because they're already white and have privilege.
But I think, you know, I think taking the lead though from people who are doing the work, instead of inviting them in, asked to be invited in, and what they're doing might flip the narrative as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So also, what do you see as far as where farmers are going? I mean, right now, the average age of farmers are 65 or older. What kinds of incentive programs do we have out there to incentivize the next generation to come up and become farmers?
Well, there are a lot of beginning farmer programs. I think that they need to refine. There needs to be some serious work in that world of how that's offered. Again, it's very often that the system works that like the USDA allocates funds to something, and then the nonprofit groups, you know, kind of then apply for the money, and then they kind of invent something to do to get the money to fund the programs. And I think that there's been one real serious analysis of beginning farmer programs. And I think that a lot of the groups that are doing those programs could look more closely at how they are supporting farmers to get in. That's one area. There's not a lot of, I mean, I think that there's loans for beginning farmers that are specific to them, those kinds of programs as well. I do think that this guy, Schaefer Ridgway, he actually is with the USDA in Iowa. He had this great ideas that he's talking about is one of the ways to bring more people in, and particularly more farmers of color, is this to make urban farming and gardening something that's really much more robust and talked about, because it's then not requiring people to like leave where they might be in order to farm. And it helps nurture people with an interest in it all. And I also think that rural development also has, like, it sounds just maybe adjacent to agriculture, but it has everything to do with agriculture, in that we need more housing in rural America. There's nowhere for people to live. So if you're a beginning farmer, good luck finding housing in order to be near the farm you want to be on. And also broadband. Like, there's now a lot of money that was released for broadband. And in Iowa, I'm on the Iowa Farmers Union board. We're trying to have somebody come talk about it, how to get the money, and, you know, and we can't even find anybody to come talk to us. So then how is that whole program going to actually work? But those are the kinds of things, like if there's housing, if there's internet to not just to be part of the modern world, but to connect with customers, those are things that help beginning farmers get going. And aren't at least barriers to entry that are, you know, insurmountable. If there's no housing, there's no housing. So I think that those things could really help.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I didn't even think of that, because one of my next questions was whether or not you saw a change since the pandemic. I mean, again, in New York, we've, you know, seen so much of an exodus out of the city now that people can work remotely. They don't need to be going into New York City. They can live further from the city and be out on the farm and, you know, be on the land and be doing their New York City job at the same time. And I was thinking that you maybe were seeing some of that same kind of thing there, but if you don't have internet and you don't have housing, that would be a problem.
Yes. That's one of the major problems. And you see that, yeah, the prosperity and the movement of people has been kind of fascinating. I've been, I've traveled a fair amount at the end of the pandemic. Well, not the end, but, you know, when we were allowed to move around until now.
Right.
And the amount of people that have moved to a place like Jackson Hole, Wyoming is mind-boggling. Like, beautiful places have attracted so many people that it makes me fearful for the environment on that aspect. Like, we can't all live in a place that has like a fragile ecosystem, no water, and, you know, just have massive concentrations of people and people flying in and out to get to their job and their second house and more heat in the house. And it just seems to me an untenable situation. And so people who are, you know, think of themselves as environmentalists and into sustainability, you can't have 2-3 homes and then eat organic and that's going to, you know, somehow come out even, you know, you'll be like neutrally, I don't know, whatever, carbon neutral. It doesn't work that way. Uh-huh. So I think that, you know, the Midwest and rural towns in rural America are not seeing that kind of prosperity. And a lack of internet is very much one of the major problems that everybody knows exists, because you can't have anybody work remotely from a town that has no high-speed internet. We have like only cell phones. Mm-hmm. So we have to use hotspots on our cell phones is how we have internet. So yes, but there's also so much opportunity in a place like a small rural town. It just feels like instead of being in a San Francisco or even a Bay Area situation where there's so much competition for everything, right? If you want to sell tomatoes, well, so are a thousand other people growing great heirloom organic tomatoes. But in a place like Iowa, that's not happening everywhere. And you have a lot more opportunity in that way. So I would argue that it's really nice to be a big fish in a small pond oftentimes in those kinds of locations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the small towns really need regentrification. They need people to come there and make them alive. I mean, you know, the stories of farmers having to travel an hour to get to a supermarket because there's no local store.
Yes.
You know, I know I've read all those kind of situations that create such barriers to moving to a rural area. And,
yes.
You know, yeah, more cooperatives and things like that springing up, you know, people working together to try to revitalize some of those towns.
Yeah, and I think too, when you're talking,
you share with them.
I just was going to say, when you're talking about, you know, people, particularly like in a tech world, people who want to live somewhere else. And I mean, there's so many really important changes that we do need to make. And one of them is like a very the logistics and the infrastructure at a local level of having people have access to more local foods and not be dependent on this, you know, giant system that breaks down as we saw in the pandemic. Like we need the brains. We just need the brains to be working on those kinds of issues. So, you know, it's a really,
absolutely.
I'm agreeing with you. It's important that people move to rural communities that really need them.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was going to ask you if you could share with us just a little bit more about your personal story now that you've made the transition and you're living in Iowa and you're working on the farm. How have you been able to turn it around and make it successful, or have you been able to?
It's a process, I would say. We haven't finally come to the end where it's sustainable financially speaking, but we stopped doing all of the corn and soybean on the farm that on the land that we're leasing. There is actually some, but it's being done by a family that grows the only organic grain in the area, so we're hoping to transition those fields also with them to organics. We have cattle that we purchased from John's dad, and we now grass finish them. So instead of the usual system where calves are sold into usually the feedlot system, they usually go at like 9 months. Instead of doing that, they stay on the farm and they eat grass their whole lives. Grass and other things, alfalfa, clover, whatever. There's a whole mix of things that you grow. And they stay on the farm their entire lives, and then they are direct marketed to customers. And we also have goats now. So the goats are incredible. They eat all of the invasive weeds like honeysuckle and multiflora rose. So they come through and they just like all of these things that farmers are out battling to get rid of. They just eat it, and they take, you know, a weed and sunshine and make high protein, you know, high value protein out of it, meat, which is an incredible natural process that I think is discredited by a lot of people who aren't into meat. So that whole cycle of having livestock on the land, particularly in the area where we are, where it is green, rolling hills, very lush. We don't irrigate. No one in the area irrigates at all. it's a system that is very sustainable. And because we move the cattle every day, it's also good for the landscape. So their manure is fertilizer, not heaps of it that we have to get rid of in some toxic sense. It's just there. So that's what we're doing now. And it's been successful thus far. We're never going to make large amounts of money. But as I make clear in the book as well, we're at a stage in life that we could do it. And that family wealth and owning our home and all of that kind of stuff is making that possible. So we won't ever make the kind of money that we, you know, I did as a professor, which, you know, mm-hmm. it's not the most, it's a lucrative job as a professor, but not, it's not, I wasn't a brain surgeon or anything. So, so it's going well.
Beth, I just want to thank you for your work and for writing your book, because it's really fascinating. It's so great to have someone that cares about the land and farming and racial equity and all of it together to really get a clearer picture of what people are up against in trying to do it right. And so thank you so much for your work. And I just want to congratulate you on the book. It's really great.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And if people want to get a copy of the book, it's through Island Press. It's for sale there on their website and also anywhere else you would get a book. The big retailers online, you can get it there too.
Yeah, I have the link on my website and I will post it again. So thank you. And everybody out there who's been listening and joining us, thank you so much for joining us. And I'll see you all again next week. Have a wonderful week. Bye for now.